It's your city. It's our job. District Council 37 of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees presents It's Your City. It's Our Job, a program highlighting the work of the 125,000 men and women of DC 37, members of 56 local unions. You'll find DC 37 members everywhere. We're the largest municipal employees union in the city. We're everything from accountants to zookeepers. We are blue-collar, white-collar, technical, and professional. We are District Council 37, working with and for the people of New York City.
Welcome to the radio program of District Council 37. I'm Ken Nash. Not a week goes by that we don't hear about cutbacks caused by the rising cost of health insurance or the growing number of Americans who are uninsured. And not a week goes by that we don't hear about a new union endorsing Representative John Conyers' single-payer health insurance bill, H.R. 676. The bill would create a publicly financed, privately delivered health care program that expands and improves that already existing under Medicare. A universal single-payer health insurance system in the United States would save at least $150 billion annually by eliminating the high overhead and profits of the private investor-owned insurance industry and reducing spending for marketing and other satellite services. Recently, Paul Krugman, professor of economics at Princeton University and op-ed columnist for the New York Times, spoke about the healthcare crisis and what to do about it at a forum sponsored by the New York City chapter of Physicians for a National Healthcare Program. Professor Krugman was introduced by Dr. Oliver Fine from PNHP.
Good evening. My name is Oliver Fine, and I am the chair of the New York Metro Chapter of Physicians for a National Health Program. Physicians for a National Health Program is a national organization with 14,000 physician and medical student members that supports universal access to health care through a single-payer financing system, an improved and expanded Medicare for All program for the United States. And now, for our featured speaker, Professor Paul Krugman. Mr. Krugman, after spending 20 years on the faculty at MIT, in 1999, he joined the faculty at Princeton University as professor of economics and international affairs. He is the author or editor of 20 books and over 200 peer-reviewed journal articles, and is probably best known to this audience as the op-ed columnist for the New York Times, authoring the first regular New York Times op-ed column devoted to economics, business, and finance. As Mr. Krugman has written in his column entitled Health Economics 101, quote, "I'm not an opponent of markets. On the contrary, I've spent a lot of my career defending their virtues. But the fact is that the free market doesn't work for health insurance." Please welcome Professor Paul Krugman.
Well, thank you. I'd like to start by talking about something which may not at first seem to have very much to do with healthcare, but I think it comes to the ultimate reason why this is such a crucial issue. You may remember those horrible few days at the end of August and the beginning of September when Katrina hit and New Orleans breached the levees. And we all watched in horror and anger as the city of New Orleans suffered, as the people were stuck, and as help failed to arrive. Those days when we couldn't believe, this is America, where is the aid? Why aren't we saving those people? Why aren't we coming to the aid of that city? And that was an appropriate reaction. We are an extremely rich country. We're a country of enormous resources. And there's one thing that all societies try to do, but that rich societies ought to be able to do quite well, which is to come to the aid of people in trouble. We don't expect people to be insulated from all or even most of the risks of life, but we do believe that we have a moral duty to our citizens to protect them, to help them when they are the victims of circumstances beyond their control and society can, in fact, come to their aid. That is ultimately what the healthcare debate is. Now, I'm an economist, I'm a quantitative guy, I do numbers and Greek letters and funny diagrams and all of those things that economists do, but ultimately this is a moral issue. Preventable illness, the personal strain, often the financial disaster that comes from illness, are things that we can take care of. We can come to the aid of our fellow citizens. And every advanced country except the United States does. Every wealthy country has basically taken that particular risk of life off the table because it's something for which we can take social responsibility. The United States is unique in being a place where illness, the costs of medical expense, can bankrupt you, or where the inability to pay for basic medical care can lead to a downward spiral in your health and often to death. It's not as conspicuous. We don't get Geraldo Rivera covering you as you are unable to afford medical care and end up dying prematurely. It happens gradually, but it's enormous. And we know that the best estimates suggest that something like 18,000 unnecessary deaths take place each year just because of inadequate health insurance. That's the equivalent of 6 9/11s every year just from that. And there's much more. There are many people who suffer, who are in ill health, who suffer the collapse of their finances, the collapse of their families, all because of this sort of basic provision that somehow every other wealthy country has managed to do, but that we have not. The American public, when asked in the abstract, you know, do you think that everyone should be guaranteed basic health care, says yes, by a very large margin. But somehow we fail to actually come up with a system that does that. Now, there are a couple of things you might say on the other side, certainly given the way that we tend to talk about things in this country. Isn't there a question of individual responsibility? Shouldn't people make their own provisions to make sure that they have health care when they need it? And on the other side, well, you know, wouldn't trying to ensure that everyone has basic health care be just too expensive? Isn't that beyond the means even of a wealthy country? The answers, of course, are, well, you know, it's actually not possible for most people to guarantee for themselves that they have health care when they need it. And that comes to the whole issue of why, in fact, free markets don't work when it comes to health insurance. I'll talk more about that in a bit. But the fact is, it doesn't work. To the extent that we have a private health insurance system at all, it's actually the result of implicit government subsidies. It's actually the result of kind of a jerry-rigged system, which is, in fact, public policy, not individual responsibility, that's made it work at all. And that system is coming apart. And as for it being too expensive, well, there are a lot of reasons to say that it isn't. But the most obvious one is simply to say, well, you know, somehow every other wealthy country does it. And what's more, they do it and somehow spend quite a lot less on healthcare than we do. I assume that many people here know these numbers, but it is stunning to realize that people talk about the British system, which is, and there's a lot of basically slander against that system in this country. It's a lot better than people will have you say, but that's a very, very cheap system. That spends, you know, 40 cents for every dollar that we spend per person treated. But there are other systems, French system, which is by most measurements better than ours. Maybe at the very cutting edge, ours is better, but that's not even clear. And yet we spend almost twice as much as the French do per person on healthcare, to far worse results. We just have a system which is the most expensive in the world and yet delivers results that are close to the bottom among advanced countries. We're basically got the same life expectancy as Costa Rica in the United States. Why do we do so badly? Well, it comes down to this inability, to the fact that healthcare must be provided primarily by insurance, and health insurance is a market that just doesn't work. The reason healthcare has to be provided by insurance, by the way, this is something that people I know, even fairly sensible people, conservative economists, it really bothers them. They don't like the idea that it's so dependent on insurance. They would like to believe that we could do more of it, that we could sell healthcare the way we sell bread. But it doesn't work that way because the fact about health expenses is that they tend to be very small for most people in any given year. Most people are healthy. Most people don't need much health care. But when they come, they're enormous. And the fact is that, well, I have talked to a couple of people who actually simply pay for all their health care out of cash and don't worry about insurance. All of them have a net worth of more than $100 million. The fact of the matter is that when serious health care costs arise, they can very easily and commonly be so large that even millionaires can be bankrupted by them. That's the nature of medicine. If you are healthy, it doesn't cost anything. If you are sick, it costs a lot, and it's very, very large. I can start rattling off statistics, but 20% of the people account for 80% of the healthcare costs. 1% account for more than 20% of the healthcare costs. It's something that's very, very concentrated. And you don't know if it's going to be you. So you have to have insurance if you're going to avail yourself of what modern medicine can do. It has to be provided by insurance. The private market doesn't manage to do that. It doesn't manage to do it for reasons that are actually very standard orthodox economics. If everyone was completely unaware of how likely they were to need expensive medical care, then maybe you could just have a system in which everybody paid the same amount. But unfortunately, while you don't know if you're going to need expensive care, you know a little bit. And that undermines the system. Just imagine an insurance company that tried to offer a one-size-fits-all policy. We'll charge a flat premium, no medical exam necessary, no questions about whether you have a pre-existing condition. We'll just pay us X amount and we will cover you. If an insurance company offered that policy and set the premium to cover the average costs of the people in the United States, well, you know what would happen. People who believe themselves to be relatively healthy wouldn't go for the program. People who knew that they were likely to have big medical bills would, and the insurance company would quickly go out of business or be forced to raise the premiums to an enormous level, which would drive out any remaining fairly healthy people. You see the point. It's not going to work. It's got a name in economics. It's called adverse selection, and it's devastating to the private insurance market. To the extent that private insurance works, there's really two ways. One is that the insurance companies spend a lot of resources trying to identify people who really, really need health insurance and then not giving it to them. That they spend an enormous amount of resources screening out the people who are likely to be expensive. Aside from the fact that that means that the people who most need care don't get it, it also means that there's a huge expense involved. And that's one thing that's absolutely consistent is that the administrative, it's one of these weird things. We live in an ideological environment where we've been trained to believe that government is bureaucratic and inefficient and lots of people pushing paper around. But it turns out that when you do have government provision of health insurance, the bureaucracy tends to be quite slim and the costs are quite small, and it's the private insurance industry that has enormous bureaucracy and enormous costs and that has a lot of people pushing paper around and so on. The other way that private insurance works is, and the reason why we've managed to sort of stagger along in our healthcare system until just about now, is that we have this institution of employer-based insurance. And there's a long story about how that came into existence. It really has a lot to do with World War II, but the big thing that sustained it is there's a tax advantage. To the extent that your employer provides insurance, the extent that your employer pays premiums, that's a form of non-taxable compensation. Never shows up in the amount you calculate for income tax, and that has sustained the system, and employers, particularly large employers, are to a certain extent able to do what private insurance companies by themselves cannot, which is to create a sort of representative pool of people. And so we've sort of staggered along for the past 60 years with this system, which most people under the age of 65 do get health insurance through their employers, but it's an enormously expensive system. And if you actually try to go through the reasons why the U.S. spends far more than everybody else and yet leaves a significant fraction of the population uninsured, it comes down to the inefficiencies of private insurance. There are some other factors, but a very large part of it is that. It's the enormous costs of the insurance companies, basically something like Medicare, about 98 cents of every dollar paid in, well, not premiums in this case, but paid in the form of payroll taxes, gets spent on actually providing health care. When you look at private insurance companies, it's more like 80 cents because it goes away. Administrative expenses and profits. But there are many additional costs. There are the costs imposed on the doctors, on the healthcare providers themselves, who have to deal with a fragmented, complex system in which they are constantly having to basically negotiate or demand or cajole payment out of many, many different insurers. Again, it comes down to the system where really everybody is trying to get somebody else to pay. And the process of simply shifting that hot potato around consumes a lot of resources. And so the end result is that we spend a great deal and actually get less health care. One thing just to say, my Princeton colleague, Uwe Reinhardt, has done a lot of work on this. The United States spends far more on health care than other advanced countries. you might think that we actually get more health care. And it turns out if you actually look at things like number of physicians, number of nurses, number of hospital beds, even at this point, a lot of the advanced medical technologies, even things like MRIs, the United States is not getting more health care. We're just paying more for the same amount of health care. And so we have this wildly inefficient system. There are other costs to the system we have, just in case killing a lot of people isn't enough. There are other costs that we have. It's definitely a drag on the economy. It's definitely a bad thing. It's bad for business. Just a point, there are really two different stories. Most large employers do provide health insurance to their employees, although there seems to be a gradual shift towards the Walmart model of not doing so. But most large employers do provide, and for that reason, they have high costs. They pay a lot. I mean, if you just look at the auto companies, there's a lot of reasons why they're in trouble, but one of them is simply that their competitors overseas are not bearing the cost of providing health care to their workers. It's being borne elsewhere. It's an interesting point that General Motors is an enthusiastic supporter of single-payer health care in Canada. General Motors Canada, in fact, all of the big three U.S. automakers are enthusiastic supporters of Medicare, which is what the Canadians call their system. And they write letters more or less every year saying, you know, do not tamper with this. It's a crucial competitive advantage. But, of course, not here. Smaller employers, many or most, don't actually provide health insurance. But that, too, is a big disadvantage. It means that they're unable to compete for workers. A lot of people might prefer to work for a small business, stick with a large business, because it's the one that provides health care. And it goes beyond that. A lot of people end up stuck in their jobs because they're afraid to lose the health insurance. People don't change when they should. There has even been some reports that some people stay stuck in their marriages or end up marrying the wrong person because we have a situation in which a lot of people are in fact held hostage by the desperate need to cling on to health insurance in a society that does not guarantee it. Single payer. In a way, there's a problem with the words because it's not a term that sounds like something we do in America. And if you say, well, single payer, people think several things. They think it's socialized medicine. Of course, we're talking about single payer on the insurance, not on the provision. There is a role for government in the actual provision of health care as well, but certainly nobody is talking about the United States moving to something like the British National Health Service, even though that system is a lot better than people think. There is an issue about it being big government. I'll come back to that in just a minute. But of course, that's largely an illusion. Let me say, we're very much the prisoners of history here. Harry Truman looked like he was going to create national health insurance back in the 1940s. It came pretty close. It was torpedoed by kind of unholy alliance between the American Medical Association and Southern politicians who didn't want to see hospitals integrated. If he had succeeded in getting that through, it would be regarded as being something as American as apple pie. We would find it inconceivable that we would have a society without such a thing. But that opportunity and several other opportunities were missed. One of the nasty consequences of that is that we've created powerful interest groups who stand opposed. The health insurance industry was not a big deal 60 years ago. Now it is. It's an enormous force. The drug industry was not what it is now, even 30 years ago. But now it's an enormous force standing against any sort of national system that might be able to bargain over drug prices. So there are powerful interest groups opposed. There ought to be powerful interest groups in favor of a national health insurance system. And the most obvious one would be business. And I will say that one of the, you might say, political economy mysteries of all of that is why we don't hear more from those companies that do provide health insurance to their workers and are being badly hurt by it. You can read the editorials, op-ed articles written by the CEO of General Motors, talk quite lucidly, quite clearly about the enormous burden that our system poses on his company. And you say, and the next paragraph is going to be the one where he says what we need is something that looks more like what Canada has. And that paragraph is never there. It always veers off. And we wonder, there's speculation about that. How much of that is it just sort of personal, afraid he wouldn't be able to show his face at the country club afterwards? Is it that the company has other interests and is just afraid to go this strongly against the doctrine of a majority in Congress and in the administration that to whom ideas like this are anathema? But we still haven't mobilized that. And I would like to believe that we will eventually get the point where the business community says, hey, you know, this is actually good for business too, and we need it. I worry a little bit that instead what we'll see is the Walmartization of corporate America, where the benefits are dropped and they no longer feel that it's their problem. It is a big concern. Still, there is a momentum building for deep reform. And the reason for that building momentum is simply that this jerry-rigged sort of kind of working system that we've had is breaking down. The cost, not because of inflation so much as because, you know, the thing about medical progress is it turns out that it keeps on allowing us to spend more on healthcare productively, but it means that the cost of health insurance keeps on rising, that it's finally reaching the point where the tax incentives for employer-based coverage no longer work. And health insurance for those under 65 is falling rapidly. I meant to say, when we talk about single payer, there is a reason why I also, like PNHP, now try to use Medicare for All. Because it's this very amazing thing. In the United States, people say, well, if you ask, do you favor a single payer healthcare system? They say, well, what's that? And you say, well, that's like what Canada has. And they've heard horror stories, which are almost entirely false, about what happens in Canada. And besides, that's foreign, and we don't do that. If you say Medicare, which is, of course, basically a single-payer system. Well, they say, you know, I like that, but it's this funny thing. There was one moment that I sort of treasure from the 2004 campaign. Didn't have a whole lot of moments I treasure, but anyway, when one Bush supporter yelled to the president, don't let the government get its hands on Medicare. People don't quite understand what's going on. This audience, I assume, is very much in favor of single payer. But there is a problem. It is a big leap. Even though Medicare for All is a slogan that is a lot easier for people to digest, and even though Medicare, you know, Medicare's existence was not a surefire thing. But now, of course, it's an enormously popular program, and it has its problems, but it's hard to imagine a country without it. But there is a real problem in extending it. And what's happening right now is there is a movement to provide some approximation to universal coverage, but in a kind of complex method that doesn't displace the role of the private insurance companies. And the most dramatic example is the Massachusetts plan, which is coming along. And, you know, what should we think about plans like that? Should we go along with it? Should we support it? To be honest, I'm a little ambivalent, but let me tell you what the issues are. The positive thing about plans like that is that, well, they do cover most of those now uninsured. And that is, after all, you know, ultimately, I can talk a lot about the economic benefits, but ultimately this is a moral issue, taking care of our fellow citizens, and you do want to do that. The downside of it is that by adding patches to the system as it now exists, I mean, the Massachusetts plan, to greatly simplify, is to require everybody to have health insurance, to tax higher income people so that you subsidize the purchase of private insurance for lower income people. So you're going to give everybody insurance, but it's through private insurance companies, and you're going to basically make, it's going to be universal because everyone must buy it like auto insurance, but you're going to provide financial aid so that those who can't afford still get it. The advantage is that those who don't have insurance get it. The disadvantage is that you have failed to address the monstrous inefficiencies of our current system. Well, I think we could support that as an interim, as a way to start, provided that we leave the route open for a conversion to a full single-payer system. And I would like to say, I understand you can't do this at the state level, but if we get anything like that at the national level, it must include an ability for people to simply say, well, you know, instead of going with that private insurance company, I just want to buy into Medicare. Just have to give them the option. And let me say, I say that knowing with certainty that if it's a fair competition, the public sector will win. This is one of those areas I have never seen a single study in which the private sector wasn't substantially less efficient in the provision of health insurance than the public sector. The great danger in all of this is that, given the political climate, that politicians responding to the interest groups will try to prevent any fair competition. In the name of private sector competitive markets, will actually try to prevent competition. And let me just tell you just briefly about Medicare Part D. Now, there is actually a Medicare Part C, which is the Medicare Advantage program, in which instead of taking direct Medicare, you go to a HMO, and Medicare pays the HMO, and it's a long story, but the actual story about that is that every time The HMOs have proven unable to compete on cost. And of course, the result, what's actually happened in Congress is that given the clear evidence that this privatization doesn't work, what they've done is actually subsidized it heavily, so that we're going to maintain a private sector role even though it's more expensive than the public sector. Now, Medicare Part D, the drug program could have been run, you know, choice. Either you go with a drug with an insurance company's drug plan, or you simply get drug insurance directly from Medicare. And we know what would have happened, which is that the drug insurance directly from Medicare would have been clearly cheaper. They would have avoided all of the extra administrative costs. So they solved that problem by not making it possible to go to Medicare directly. Set it up so that you can only go through private sector middlemen. And so the route, the clear test on the route to an actual rational program, you know, provides people with drug insurance by providing people with drug insurance, instead of by subsidizing private companies to maybe possibly sort of provide drug insurance to people, was ruled out. And that's what we have to avoid in this transition. The pressure to do something about the growing problem of the uninsured is enormous. The odds are it's going to be easier to get some kind of jerry-rigged complex solution than it would be to get a straight program. I'm not sure whether one should simply oppose that, but it's clear that you have to leave the route open. All of that is political judgment. What do I think we should really do? Well, what we really should do is simply Medicare for all. People are, you know, H.R. 676. I'm not going to go to the wall for every clause in it, but that's clearly the way to do it. And the fact of the matter is, it happens to be an almost complete winner. Almost nobody would end up paying more. The premiums you now pay or that your employer now pays would be paid instead in the form of a payroll tax, but you'd end up getting more health care for less money. And we'd resolve the great injustice of our current system, which is the existence of large numbers of people who don't get adequate health care simply because they've fallen through the cracks of the system. And I just want to, in the end, come back to that. It so happens that this is a vast moral issue that we can resolve, it turns out, not just for free, actually at negative cost. Turns out that all the evidence says that we could cover all the uninsured, guarantee essential health care to everyone, and actually save money in the process. But even if that wasn't true, we still should do it. Ultimately, this is a moral issue. We are a society, we are a community, and we shouldn't allow our fellow citizens to go bankrupt, suffer ill health, or die simply because we aren't ready to take care of them. Thank you.
You've been listening to Professor Paul Krugman talking about Medicare for All at a talk recently sponsored by the New York City chapter of Physicians for a National Healthcare Program. For more information, go to www.pnhpnyc.org. That's www.pnhpnyc.org. And that's all for this special edition of DC 37 Radio. DC 37 Radio is broadcast on Sundays at 8 p.m. and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. over WNYE 91.5 FM. And for more DC 37 news, views, and updates, check the DC 37 website at www.dc37.net. That's www.dc37.net, where you can also listen to archived DC 37 radio programs. And for DC 37, this is Ken Nash. In solidarity.
It's your city. It's our job. District Council 37 of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees has presented a program highlighting the work of the 125,000 men and women of DC 37, members of 56 local unions who work with and for the people of New York City.